accession number 18822, reel 15.
I'd passed all my exams in the first 18 months. Well, I was given 3 years to do it, and if you failed at the end of your third year, you were given no more increments until you had passed all the papers. So I was very pleased to have passed that. And but I failed to find favour with the resident. There was one odd incident. A chap called Jock Neal came out on contract, and he passed through my area measuring was enormously long change, measuring for the survey department the possibility of a north-south road, which we hadn't got. And he was an odd chap. He'd won an immediate DSO at Arnhem and was in the habit of getting his battle dress and putting it over a chair so that you could see the DSO ribbon and the campaign ribbons. But apart from that, he was a reasonable sort of chap. And then months later, I got a signal from the director of audit saying that Jock Neal had made a claim for, I think, 15 labourers for his own personal loads and effects, and about as many again for carrying these survey chains and equipment. And he had claimed on the same day to have done this in two different places. In fact, it actually got paid for it. And I wrote back saying that Jock Neal, DSO, had declined re-engagement at the end of his first 18 months and had got a better paid job in Malaya. And I suggested that the entire correspondence should be copied to the government of Malaya, with a further copy to the commander, local communist forces, in case he should be more closely in touch. And I regarded that as quite funny, ha-ha. A director of audit took it in good part. I think they did standard things applying to Malaya. Oh, and I added, and although it may not be altogether suitable for audit purposes, the chances are that Jock Neal actually was in two places at one and the same time. See, so it was I was trying to be ha-ha the whole time. And then, towards the end of my 18 months, Backhouse came down on me like a ton of bricks. He said I'd been hoodwinked by the local treasurer. He implied I was a bit of a wimp. I was lacking in decision, tending to put off decisions until I had a chance to discuss it with Dio Contagora, and that took, you know, a couple of months perhaps before I had, and that was really far too long. And finally, I lacked what every administrative officer should have, an instinctive knowledge of exactly what to do next, without having to think about it or discuss it. The best administrative officers just knew instinctively what to do next in any given situation. And also in the Jock Neal case, that kind of puerile schoolboy humour was lacking in the kind of gravitas he expected in behaviour of residents, behaviour of his district staff. And for all these, he wrote out two carefully worded written warnings. And that was quite serious, because any written warning would put you back 1 6-month promotion list. So with those two warnings in my first tour, I'd lost a year of seniority. And then, worse than that, I had very little pensionable service. The whole of the war was non-pensionable. The whole of the administrative training course at Cambridge and at London was not pensionable. The voyage out was not pensionable. The time we had to wait until a boat was available, which was nearly 2 months, that was not pensionable. You were not pensionable until your foot touched the docks at a papa. And so there I was, 29 years old, 6 years war service, 15 months at Cambridge and London, and various delays while I had interviews to get the job and delays while I waited for the mail boat and so on. And I was practically in my 30th year before I began to be pensionable. So I tried to resign, but Backhouse said that he would see to it that I would be surcharged the entire cost of the Devonshire course if I tried to resign. But I was a soldier on until such time as I had been confirmed an appointment, which is normally 3 years adequate service plus passing all known exams, language and all the other ones I mentioned. So so I was pretty depressed at the end of my first tour, and he said he posted me to what was known as a punishment station, a place called Oturkpo, just north of the Igbo boundary, between the River Benue and Igbo country. There was a tribe called the Adoma who were really rather difficult and unpleasant. You never got anything done, so it was very difficult to write reports that got you any brownie points, because the Adoma would not take a decision until every single tax-paying adult male had agreed to whatever the decision was. If you just got one chap who dug his toes in and refused, the Adoma would just say, we're not going to do it. So that was a bit difficult.
How do you spell Adoma?
Idoma.
And what was the name of the station?
Oturukpo.
Can you spell that?
Oturkpo. Being that far south, the climate was worse than usual, and there was trouble with the Igbos. The Igbos suffered from land hunger, and their great big yam heaps, nearly a yard high, were farmed right up to the last yard of the boundary, and they used to keep up digging up boundary stones at night and quietly shifting them a bit further so they get a bit more land. And the Adoma had lots of land available for... They were only 100,000 strong, was plenty of land. The Igbos were much denser on the ground and needed the land, but the Adoma dug their toes in, and it was generally agreed in federal headquarters that it was better not to move a boundary, no matter what the need and the circumstances, because the experience was that invariably a move of a boundary created more problems than it solved. And so we had this festering trouble at the bottom end of the division, and the climate, and the Adoma people themselves, and they were awkward. They would never accept any money for whatever was done. If they got together and built a concrete culvert, the cost of the culvert, cement and labour and so on, they insisted they were paid in individual pennies, so there'd be 240 for every single pound. And they sometimes wanted a coin called an anini, being a tenth of a penny. So there would be 2,400 individual coins in a pound. And they were bloody-minded difficult, and if you didn't oblige them with that kind of payment, which is terribly awkward, you had to count out thousands of coins to meet even quite small sums. There were problems. Oh, and there was tsetse. I had to sell my horse. I had to sell it at a loss. I couldn't get the price I paid for it. I wasn't riding anymore. I would get up for my day's tour, and very quickly there'd be the ominous trickle of sweat down your spine. You realize you had another stinking day, and you had either a bicycle or on foot to go 15 miles. So it was a punishment station, and generally speaking, was a loss of seniority, the written warnings on my confidential personal file, and 18 months in a punishment station. That was a bad first tour. However, another factor against the Doma was they scarcely spoke a word of Hausa. And if you had were to pass your Hausa exam, and better still, move onwards from the first exam and take what's called the intermediate exam and get some brownie points for passing Hausa intermediate, Idoma was useless. The language was so extraordinary. An American anthropologist once said, "The Idoma language is the darndest thing ever dreamed up by the human race for its own amusement." And only two European British officers had ever managed to make any headway with Idoma. So there it was. Every known defect, a punishment posting. However, I on later tours, I never served in a Hausa speaking area, but I served in areas where it was a lingua franca. And all over most of Nigeria, people would speak, going to women taking produce to markets or anywhere. Almost everybody spoke a dozen, two dozen, 50 words, perhaps 300 words of Hausa. It was the lingua franca of northern Nigeria. Now, it was an interesting language in that it had some affinities with Arabic, but the pronouns inflected, and if you wrote out the pronouns, you could parallel Latin grammar, and instead of amo, amas, amat, you would say ya, 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 na. You could really write out an almost exact and it wasn't tonal, and that was one of the reasons why the Igbo, Yoruba and other languages like Idoma, being tonal, it was very difficult for a British officer to get down to it. So there was Hausa, a non-tonal language, a recognisable grammar, and if you met anybody, there was a system of greetings. No matter how urgent the thing you wanted to talk about was, you would have to go through. He would say to you, "In Labari, what is your news?" And you had to say, "Sai al-Heri," meaning, "My news is good." And then he would say, "Yaya Gajia, how is your fatigue?" And I'd say, "Bagajia, I have no fatigue." And he would say, "Yaya Jiki," and I would say, "My body is well." And we go on and on with what appeared to be pointless things, but the whole time you were doing that, the Hausa was working out, who is he, what's his status, what powers has he, what does he want, is he going to bring trouble, is it a proposed business deal, or is he just passing through and just wants to check up that I'm at the office and during office hours, or or something. The whole of the time you're seeing these pointless things, he is assessing you. And finally he will say, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which means, okay, I've got the general idea who you are, what your powers are, and what you want. Let's get down to business.
So why can't you just be direct and say, I've come for something?
Because it would... that's what Americans, when we started to get American aid, they used to get furious. They'd have a very tight schedule, and they were required in Kano Airport by 6 p.m. the next day or something. They'd have to go through it. Otherwise, the Hausa would clam up. No Hausa would start dealing with what was needed to be done until he had satisfied himself by means of these greetings, from your tone of voice, your body language, and what he could find out about you. He knew all about you before the start. There was no good arguing. They wouldn't do things in any other way. At the same time, you should watch him, because if he greeted you by just doing that with a on the ground,
that's putting your thumb
down. Yes, but if he did that, both hands on the ground
with all the fingers just
sustained, you were okay. He approved of you or something, but if it was perfunctory, that thing's not so good. And if he pulled down, the houses wore enormous great cotton robes. The general idea was that if you kept your sweat inside your clothing and your body running with sweat, it was better than drying out in that climate. Is that mean? Physically, it was better. And they have something around around their heads and finish it around their necks and tucked in there. If he pulled that right down...
To reveal his mouth?
Yes, to reveal his mouth and chin, you were okay. But if he just did a perfunctory tug, something was wrong. I can't remember any particular incident, but you knew if he was perfunctory with his touching the ground and pulling down his chin cloth, you're going to have difficulty in getting your point of view accepted and so on. So you watched him and he watched you. But I never knew a single American... Ford Foundation, USAID. I think there was one chap from Massachusetts Institute of Technology that got the drift of this. Otherwise, in the days when there were American experts were coming around with money available for development projects, they never got on with the Hausa in northern Nigeria. And then, when you spoke, the Hausa would say something like, Watarana wani mutum ya badamamaki, and stop, and you would say, to, meaning indeed. And then he'd say, yaitika omutani kuzo muislami, or something like that, expressing his point of view, and stop. And you would say something like, hakika, certainly. And he would break up what he had to say, and you would say, indeed, hakika, gaskene, that is indeed the truth, or mungodi Allah, I thank Allah that it should be so, every time he stopped. And that meant, I have followed you so far, and agree. And if you were saying, putting across something to him, the same thing had happened. You mustn't, no matter how good your Hausa, you mustn't just stream away. You must stop at every phrase, and he would say one of these meaningless things, certainly the truth, indeed. And that meant, I have followed you so far, and I agree. And if he didn't follow you, or he was not going to agree, he would say, or you could say to him, or he could say to you, Gafra malam, may you be forgiven, O learned one. That won't, you know, I'm not with you there. I haven't understood you, or I'm not prepared to accept it. So, phrase by phrase, with the Americans standing by with their tight time schedules, you would go through some particular business and reach some agreement. And there was no good trying to buck that system. That was the way Northern Nigeria worked. And another point, it was the height of bad manners to foist your own troubles onto a third party. Let us say the man you were talking to, his wife had just died in childbirth, his cattle had all got rinderpest, his reserve of grain had been accidentally burnt in a dry season fire, and his eldest son had been caught bang for rights stealing in the market. And he was absolutely desperate with all these difficulties, anxieties and worries. But he had to say, Duka lafi alau, all is well. You're never allowed, at the height of bad manners, other people had their own problems, you mustn't express or try and foist your problems onto somebody else. That was a tribal custom. They called customs al-hadu. It wasn't done. There are things you did, things that weren't done. And foisting troubles was one of the things you simply did not do. And so we had in Nigeria about 20 million Hausa speaking Muslims in the north, another 20 million people speaking 237 or more separate languages, all pagans, small units difficult to minister in the middle belt, and sophisticated, more or less educated Yorubas and Igbos in the south. And the boundaries of Northern Nigeria fixed, I think, they started fixing them with the Treaty of Berlin in 1887, and they were finally fixed by Lord Lugard after, by right of conquest, he beat the Northern Army at Kano in 1903. And I sometimes think that the boundary commissioners, the one I knew best was on the west of Nigeria with French territory, and I said, the boundary is so badly drawn, going slapped through villages where the western side of the village, all the people can speak at least three words of French, saying bonjour monsieur or something, and on the other side they spoke no English but would greet you in Hausa. And I thought that if you were able to follow the line carefully, you would find every few yards a bottle of whiskey from the British officer in charge of that particular boundary commission, and every few yards a bottle of wine from the French chap. I mean, I couldn't think of any other way in which the boundaries were badly drawn. And we had these totally disparate tribes with different languages, cultures, different strengths and weaknesses, all described as Nigerians. So, then, British living conditions for the British officers were rough. Except in Lagos and parts of regional headquarters at Kaduna, nobody had electricity or running water. After, by about 1952, after a 4 or 5 years service, we were all issued with kerosene burning refrigerators. And this was because people were simply quietly resigning. The climate was too bad, the conditions too difficult, the mud and thatch huts you lived in were not better. Mud and thatch was better than, say, corrugated iron or other building materials because it was cooler. But you could, I found in the Mud and Thatch, once there was a cobra, only once, and I got my 12 bore and took aim, and it rose, ooh, a good 18 inches or more, and like cobras do, it sort of expanded its neck, hood, and spat at me. But one single shot got rid of that. And then not far from, between my hut and the village, the locals demanded that I should shoot a python. And I didn't think pythons really did any harm, but I did actually shoot it more to placate the local people than feeling I was doing the right thing. It was 14 foot long, really quite a good one. And another factor of mud and thatch huts was scorpions. They were sort of, you had to be very careful, shake your shoes out every morning before you put a foot in. And if you did forget, put your foot in, you felt something, don't pull your foot out, stamp, and hope for the best. It wasn't the big black scorpions that looked so large and dramatic, the size of your fist. It was the little brown ones that stung just as badly, but were indistinguishable from a spider, well, almost indistinguishable from a spider. And I once, two of them dropped to the ground near me, and both my children were playing on a mat just a few feet away from two little brown scorpions. And I had both of those children out into the open as fast as you could. My steward's wife got stung by a scorpion, and she screamed this place down. You could hear her at a quarter of a mile. And then the local dispenser astounded me by coming up with a bottle of medicine normally taken orally as a specific against amoebic dysentery. And he got a syringe and put this medicine in the syringe and got the wife to say roughly where the greatest hurt was and tried to see the sting point. And he injected her foot with this, and she stopped screaming and said, "Now I fear, I'm all right. The my foot feels heavy, but the pain has gone." And to this day, it was a medical specific issued to dispensers in Nigeria to be taken orally against amoebic dysentery. And I said, who told you this? And he said, there was a doctor who was an Irishman, usually drunk, and it was he told me they'd found out that this was okay against scorpions. So, but I can't remember the name of the medicine, except it began with M. Perhaps one day it'll suddenly come to me. I might try. There's a very short story which the house hour it thought was funny, and it helps you to understand the house hour. It runs. Wataranamonimutum yabadu.